good afternoon, everyone. My name is Margot Pierce. I'm a PhD candidate with the School of Population and Public Health at UBC. I'm very honored to be here today to present to you a CEDAR project study that looks at the continuing effects of childhood maltreatment on HIV risk amongst young Indigenous people who use drugs in three Canadian cities. I'd like to first take a moment by extending my gratitude to the young people who participate in the CEDAR project study. CEDAR project participants are some of the most courageous young people I have ever met, and I'm deeply honored that they have shared their experiences with us. I would also like to thank the elders, leaders, and experts who are part of the CEDAR Project Partnership, who have guided this entire research process, with special thanks to my mentor, Earl Henderson and Violet Balzalki and Cook B. Wayne Christian. In addition, I'd like to thank the study staff from all three study sites for their conviction and dedication to this study, because without them, this work would not be possible. And finally, usually I co-present with an Indigenous author who is unfortunately, we're a long way from home, and so we're unable to co-present for this presentation, so I'll be doing my best on my own. And I have no conflict of interest to the clinic. In the 500 years since European colonization of North America, Indigenous peoples have been forced to endure many changes and atrocities, including forced removal from traditional lands, spiritual connections to the lands, cultural genocide, and in particular, systemic apprehension of their children. The National Residential School System in Canada removed well over 150,000 Indigenous children from their home, their communities, and their families, and systemically devalued their Indigenous identities. Testimony from thousands of former residential school students have also demonstrated that the schools were opportunistic sites for emotional abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. In addition, a staggering number of children died there due to neglect, and most of those who survived were irreparably harmed spiritually, emotionally, mentally, and physically. Oops. The era of the residential schools was intersected by social and child welfare policies that capitalized on the number of Indigenous families who were in crisis. In the absence of viable economic self-determination or social supports, Indigenous families who are coping with poverty, unresolved grief, and substance use were targeted by provincial child welfare agencies. Subsequently, throughout the 1960s, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were removed from their homes and placed into predominantly white homes. This period was characterized as the 60s scoop. What is startling is that the same child welfare policies continue to this day. And as a result, although only 8% of children in Canada are Indigenous children, 52% of children who are in foster care are Indigenous children. If you ever get a chance to read this book, Stolen from Our Embrace, I would highly recommend it to understand this situation. Indigenous scholars have drawn associations between colonization and the residential school and child welfare systems with present-day health, social, and economic disparities between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada. And perhaps there's no more telling outcome related to these disparities than the disproportionate number of Indigenous people who are living with HIV and hepatitis C infections in Canada. A unique feature of these epidemics is that injection drug use remains the primary mode of transmission for both viruses amongst Indigenous people. Moreover, Indigenous women and young people under the age of 30 are vastly overrepresented amongst those living with HIV and those vulnerable to infection. As you may be aware, British Columbia, and especially the city of Vancouver, has historically been the epicenter for HIV infection in Canada. Nevertheless, HIV service organizations in the north of the province have become increasingly concerned about HIV and hepatitis C epidemics and the lack of adequate harm reduction and treatment services that are available there. The CEDAR project was initiated in 2003 in a response to the HIV and hepatitis C epidemics amongst young Indigenous people who use drugs in Vancouver and to the simmering epidemics in the north of the province. The CEDAR project is a collaborative, community-governed cohort study of young Indigenous people who use drugs, are aged 14 to 30, and live in Vancouver and Prince George, and as of 2010, in Chase, British Columbia. The CEDAR project questionnaires are very comprehensive, and we follow up on participants every 6 months. The overall goal of the CEDAR project was to provide Indigenous communities with the information they needed to lobby on behalf of their children and young people. These communities and their leaders have for a long time known that historical trauma has impacted the health of their young people. However, they required an evidence base for public health interventions, and previous to the CEDAR project, this has been lacking. So this is a map of British Columbia and the three study locations in British Columbia. Since the inception of the study, we have received governance and oversight from the CEDAR Project Partnership, which is a body of Indigenous leaders, elders, and community members, and health and social services experts who meet quarterly. And this is a list of those partners. Here's a list of some of the primary functions of the partnership. The primary purpose of the partnership is to provide governance, protection, leadership, and support to the study, and to make sure that we function using the decolonizing principles of Indigenous research methods. So the partnership has ensured that we adhere to OCAP, which is Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession. These are unique to research involving Indigenous people in Canada, and these inform our overall ethical framework. In addition, each of the research questions and objectives of this work I'm about to present was specifically requested by the partnership, and I regularly presented these results to the partnership over the past 5 years at quarterly meetings where the partnership has been involved in the interpretation of each of the results. In addition, as a non-First Nations researcher, I've benefited greatly from the Indigenous mentorship program. From the outset of my PhD training, I've been mentored by Earl Henderson, who is a Cree and Métis elder, healer, and scholar. Earl has educated me about how to conduct myself in a culturally safe manner and has approved all of the findings and the interpretation of these of this study. I'm excited today to say that next month Earl and I are meeting to work together on a community engagement and knowledge translation strategy for the community. And now we'll provide a background and rationale for this research. It's widely accepted that prior to colonization, instances of childhood maltreatment and family violence within Indigenous families was rare. However, in the aftermath, we now know that Indigenous children experience maltreatment more often than non-Indigenous children. In 2008, I had the opportunity to be a part of this CEDAR Project publication that demonstrated the strong relationship between historical trauma and sexual abuse, and then associations between sexual abuse and mental health and HIV risk amongst participants. This work received significant media attention and generated many discussions within Indigenous leadership about sexual abuse within Indigenous families. Based on this work, we were specifically requested by the partnership to look more closely at the intersections between multiple different types of trauma with mental health, and also the intersection between trauma and resilience, and how these experiences were impacting CEDAR Project participants. This is a very important body of work because there's still very much a lack of understanding about how to support the mental health of young Indigenous people who have experienced trauma and who may be living in cities away from their communities, away from their cultures and their languages and spirituality. The objectives of this study were therefore to first test the CEDAR Project data using the childhood trauma questionnaire, and this was to see whether or not the CTQ measures fit the data. The second was to describe the frequency of childhood maltreatment experiences among CEDAR participants, including any gender differences. And the third was to examine longitudinal associations between exposure to childhood maltreatment and HIV risk behaviors and other health outcomes. Here's an overview of the study methods. Participants were included in this study if they had completed the childhood trauma questionnaire and had returned for at least one of 15 follow-up interviews between 2003 and 2012. First, descriptive statistics were carried out according to the CTQ authors and also comparisons between men and women. We also carried out confirmatory factor analysis on the CTQ. And finally, we used generalized linear mixed effects models to estimate the effects of childhood maltreatment on the likelihood of behavioral and HIV risk outcomes between 2003 and 2012, with the odds ratio being the measure of association. And we carried out separate models for men and women. We used the childhood maltreatment summary score because we were interested in understanding the impact of experiencing multiple different types of maltreatment by characterizing the total dose of exposure to childhood maltreatment on health outcomes. So an additional maltreatment summary score was created by first categorizing participants into maltreated or not maltreated based on the CTQ-5, the subscales, and then summing the number of thresholds that were exceeded. So the maltreatment summary score ranged from 0 to 5 and was treated as a continuous variable. So the odds ratio in this study could therefore be interpreted as the likelihood of an outcome with each incremental increase for the maltreatment summary score. So here in Table 1, we have the descriptive statistics for this study. Overall, 266 participants were eligible. Women made up about 53% and men were 47%. The mean age of all participants at baseline was just under 23 years. Nearly half of the participants had at least one parent who attended residential school, and two-thirds had ever been in foster care. The only significant difference here was the relationship status at baseline. However, here in Table 2, you'll see many more differences between men and women. This table presents all of the childhood maltreatment types overall and compared between men and women. So aside from emotional neglect, there are high proportions of participants who are in the severe categories of maltreatment. A particular concern here is the 41% participants who had severe physical abuse and the 39% who had severe sexual abuse. When these frequencies were stratified by sex, it was clear that aside from emotional neglect, women were significantly and more severely impacted by trauma. For example, 48% of the women reported severe emotional abuse versus 21% of the men. 47% of the women had severe physical abuse versus 37% of the men. 53% of the women reported severe sexual abuse compared to 24% of the men. And 48% of the women reported severe physical neglect compared to 31% of the men. The maltreatment summary score demonstrated that only just under 9% of the participants had no maltreatment experiences at all. So the rates of maltreatment in this particular group of young people is very, very high. When the young men and women were observed separately, there were very strong significant differences in the score, as women were more likely than men to have all five types of maltreatment, while men were more likely than women to have fewer maltreatment scores that exceeded clinical thresholds. I'm not going to go too much into these numbers, but basically what this tells us is that we could be confident in the CTQ instrument as a measure of childhood maltreatment amongst young Indigenous people who use drugs. In Table 6, we have the unadjusted and adjusted odds ratios for study outcomes related to the childhood maltreatment summary score amongst men only. In the adjusted models, for each incremental increase in the maltreatments, the odds for accessing drug or alcohol treatment actually increased by 12%. The likelihood for being involved in sex work increased by an odds of 2.19. The likelihood for unsafe sex with casual partners increased by 44%. The likelihood for daily or more opiate injection increased by nearly three times, and the likelihood for sharing rigs increased by 52%. So just to put this risk into perspective for you, if a young man in this study had one type of maltreatment, his odds for sharing rigs was 52%, increased by 52%. If he had three types of maltreatment, his odds increased by 3.5 times. And if he had all five types of maltreatments, his odds for sharing rigs increased by eight times. In Table 6, we have the unadjusted and adjusted odds for study outcomes related to the maltreatment summary score for women only. In the adjusted models for each incremental increase in the maltreatment summary score, the likelihood for sleeping on the streets for over three nights increased by 31%. The likelihood for binge drinking increased by 50%. The likelihood for having blackouts due to drinking increased by 33%. The likelihood for having unsafe sex with regular sexual partners increased by 48%. And the likelihood of going on binges with injection drugs increased by 35%. And once again, to put this into perspective for you, if a young woman in this study had one type of maltreatment, her odds for going on binges with injection drugs increased by 35%. If she had three types of maltreatment, her odds increased by 2.5 times. And if she had all five types of maltreatment, her odds increased by 4.5 times. So I think this really exemplifies that dramatic increase in risk with each additional type of maltreatment that these young people had experienced. So this relates to injection drug use risk and then by association to HIV and hepatitis C risk. So in summary, the CTQ has demonstrated its validity for use among CEDAR participants, and the proportions of participants in the study who experienced severe abuse and neglect is very high and very concerning. Differences in the frequencies of maltreatment between men and women were very significant, with women being at higher risk. With each additional number of maltreatment experiences, the young men in this study were at greater risk for sex work, unsafe sex with casual sexual partners, high-frequency opiate injection, and were more likely to share rigs. With each additional number of maltreatment experiences amongst the young women, they were at greater risk for homelessness, problem drinking, unsafe sex with regular sexual partners, and binge injection drug use. The work of this dissertation has provided much needed evidence for the development of a First Nations designed and directed child advocacy center. CACs adopt seamless, coordinated, and multidisciplinary responses to addressing the needs of youth and child victims of sexual crimes that minimizes systems-induced trauma. The CAC model has been widely adopted in the United States, but it's relatively new in Canada, and there's a small number of Native American communities who have incorporated culture, traditions, and healing strategies into the model. In April of this year, 56 First Nations leaders who are part of the British Columbia Northern First Nations Child and Family Services Council Task Force unanimously passed a resolution in support of this initiative, and community consultations are now underway. This CAC is the third Indigenous CAC, which is in the feasibility and assessment phase of development in Canada, and it is right here in the north of British Columbia. And just in closing, I'd like to say that public health must support this initiative by collaborating with this council and providing Indigenous children and families with culturally safe, trauma-informed care services within public health and also within the CAC framework. Thank you very much. Right. So the CTQ is comprised of 25 items and measuring five different types of abuse. And each of the five different types of abuse has five different questions that a participant would fill out. So it's all self-reported. So it measures the severity and the frequency of different maltreatments. So it is a subjective measure. Was that your question?
Yeah.
As far as the childhood maltreatment questionnaire refers to experiences only in childhood, did you mean the sexual assault variable later? Or yeah, so we did ask if you had experienced any kind of unwanted sexual activity in the last 6 months. So that could be rape or sexual assault or being molested without your consent. So that was measured in the last 6 months. Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we know for sure is that the young women in this study were disproportionately affected by abuse and neglect, but we also know that young men in the study underreport their experiences, especially when it comes to sexual abuse and neglect. As far as the outcomes, I was surprised that the young men in the study were more likely to be in sex work as a result of or related to childhood maltreatment. But when I looked closer at that data, what we found was that the majority of young women in this study who had severe childhood maltreatment had been in sex work already. So there was like a collinearity over time. And so I think the issue is that for young women, we know that childhood maltreatment is related to sex work involvement. But I think that over the study period, we weren't able to see that difference between participants because so many of the young women were already in sex work at the beginning of the study. So that was one of the outcomes. As far as rig sharing and those kinds of outcomes, this is sort of the first time that we've been able to really look at those relationships amongst young people who use drugs. But we do know that young Aboriginal women in particular face an amazing amount of violence in the street, an amazing amount of a lack of safety in the streets. And so I think that accessing harm reduction has been especially difficult. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm able to answer that question very well, but...
The other question, I think kind of following up with that, I wonder where there's an intersection between the young men more specifically, because I try to understand the 8 times increase in
Wait,
yeah. Where my sexual orientation play a role in that issue?
I actually did adjust for, where I tested for sexual orientation, and there was absolutely no difference between young men who identified as gay or trans. So it wasn't an issue of sexual identity, which is very interesting. I think that the young men may face a lot of barriers with accessing harm reduction. And so rig sharing, while it shouldn't be happening in such an area of Vancouver where harm reduction treatment and services are widely available. However, in the north of the province, harm reduction is not as widely available, so it could be an instance of location as well.
And the last question, I'm not supposed to ask it, but the piece of record thinking about how the young men, more specifically, how the gender plays going to play out a role. So, how do young men understand what it means to be a man versus a woman, and how that kind of related to the risk that they experience and the risk that they will need to endorse and actually
In the literature, it shows that though maltreatment impacts young people are impacted equally severely by maltreatment, but the way in which it plays out over the life course can be very different between men and women. And you're right in that, you know, young men may face significant moral challenges to their sexual identity, to their ability to adapt. Because of that, whereas young women face more systemic violence just through virtue of being feminine. So, it's difficult to say from this data what that really was about. But I did know that, stratifying for men and women was the approach I wanted to take in order to really see the differences.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in that way, as opposed to adjusting for sex. Yeah. So the STD variable in this study was self-reported. However, in other CEDAR project work, we do have tests for syphilis and gonorrhea and HPV and such like that. So how young were the participants when they were reporting? Our recruitment involved participants who were age 14 to 30 at baseline. And then the study lasted for 10 years. So we have, some participants who are in their late 30s by the end of the study period. And we asked questions every 6 months. So it was longitudinal. That actually, that's chapter 8 of my dissertation, where I look at risk and protective factors for resilience. And we used, actually chapter 5 and chapter 8, because I did a qualitative study looking at sources of strength and hope amongst these young people and ways in which they were really related to what, the qualitative work and what you're talking about earlier, which was negotiating street life and the ideals of what these young people really like for their lives, and then the systemic barriers that they face every day. And so there's that qualitative piece, and then the quantitative piece was we used a scale called the Connor Davidson Resilience Scale to look at risk and protective factors associated with resilience. And the real silver lining in this whole work that we've done is that we saw that the young people who had access to their traditional languages, to their cultures, to their to family, had much higher resilience scores than participants who didn't. And so it really validates what Indigenous scholars and elders and leaders have said for hundreds of years, which is that the foundations of resilience amongst Indigenous people are rooted in culture and languages and spirituality and traditions. And so we were able to show that through the data, which was a really a wonderful way to end this whole project.